A graphic novel about the Hollywood blacklist.
This period, which so offended me and outraged me, that having the wrong politics didn't allow you to do what you had trained your life to do, politicized me in a way that kept moving me in political directions, I guess for the rest of my life to this very moment.
That's the great Jules Pfeiffer. We talk with him about the third in his noir trilogy about the Hollywood blacklist of the 1940s and 50s, The Ghost Script. Then we replay part of our 2008 interview with comic artist Art Spiegelman, and we remember the great Israeli writer Amos Oz. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Jules Pfeiffer is the celebrated dean of American cartooning, with a career spanning from 1946 to today. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1986 as America's leading editorial cartoonist, and in 2004 he was inducted into the Comic Book Hall of Fame. Pfeiffer was born in 1929, an auspicious year for the future cartoonist, as he told Writer's Voice, because it was the year Popeye was born, a cartoon that became an early inspiration for him. Now, just a few weeks from his 90th birthday, Pfeiffer is still going strong with his art. I spoke with him recently about his latest book, a graphic novel in the noir genre about the Hollywood blacklist. The Ghost Script is actually the last in the Kill My Mother trilogy about the blacklist. The Washington Post called it a political masterwork and one of the best books of 2018. The Hollywood blacklist began in 1947, when screenwriters in Hollywood were denied employment because they were suspected of being communist sympathizers. It's a topic close to Pfeiffer's heart. In addition to being a cartoonist, he's a playwright and screenwriter. So the whole notion of screenwriters being denied the opportunity to practice a craft because of their political beliefs or suspected beliefs is not only anathema to him, it's personal, as it should be to all of us. The Ghost Script contains lessons that are acutely relevant today. But the story Pfeiffer tells is also a whodunit, each frame of which never fails to entertain. I called Jules Pfeiffer at his home on Shelter Island, New York, and started out by referencing his iconic cartoons featuring a modern dancer, invariably called A Dance to Spring. So I just want to tell you before we start that I can remember just loving your Dance to Spring when I was a kid, the various iterations of it, because my mother was a modern dancer. And they captured her perfectly.
Well, the dancer came about because the first young woman I ever slept with in the 1950s, shortly after I got out of the army, was a modern dancer who started taking me to dance recitals. And what interested me most about the recitals was not so much the dance, but in those years, this was in the Village and its environs in New York, the dancers would walk on stage. They wouldn't so much walk as trudge on stage heavily, counter dancing, and explain to you what they were about to do. And their explanation for the dance, I thought, had very little to do with what I actually saw. And I loved the explanation much more than I did the dance, and that is what started my whole dance craze.
Well, they were just wonderful. And Jules Pfeiffer, I want to welcome you to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So your latest book, The Ghost Script, this is the third in a trilogy, of which the first two are Kill My Mother and Cousin Joseph. Cousin Joseph figures prominently in this one. Just briefly tell us about the first two books, just to give us the background.
Well, you're asking somebody who's going to be 90 in January. Who remembers? but it all came about simply because I had aged out of doing the things I had been doing for years. I was writing for the theater. I had been doing occasional screenplays. And my hearing had disappeared on me, starting in my mid-70s or so. And it became harder and harder to do theater because you go to rehearsals and you have to understand what's being said and you have to be helpful and pick up on things. So it was the ongoing age that taught me that I had to get out of the business that I was having so much fun in and actually get out of New York City, which I couldn't operate in anymore because I couldn't navigate around it with any ease. And I walked miles, and now I couldn't, now it was hard to get to go a couple of blocks. Everything became difficult, and everything became a reminder of my own mortality. And it was a time for me to get out of the city or just die, because the city was reminding me of how broken down I was. So I moved out to Long Island, the east end of Old Long Island. I had been teaching a class out here once a week at Stony Brook Southampton College. And I had friends here and started living here. But once I was out here and living in a little cottage, I had to figure out what I was going to do. And I thought, I'd always loved noir, and I thought I'd write a piece of noir fiction. And as I spent a couple of days on that and got nowhere, I decided that I wasn't interested in noir enough to write noir fiction. So I tried to do it as a graphic novel and see how that turned up. Understanding that if I did anything I really liked, I couldn't illustrate it because I couldn't draw in that style. I didn't know how. So I started working, and it turned out to be a story set in the Depression, in the Great Depression of the 1930s. The reason being that I understood that I didn't understand anything going on in America over the last 25 or 30 years, or didn't understand it enough to actually write with any kind of clarity about it or any kind of knowledge about it. So I had to go back to my early years, my childhood, and it was the Depression years that I was brought up in. I was born in 1929, the year that Popeye was born in, and by the great E.C. Segar. And I started on this thing not knowing where it was going, and because my intuition always goes counter to what I think I'm going to do, instead of writing about private eyes at the centerpiece, I wrote about women being at the centerpiece of this noir fiction, and began enjoying that with the private eye in it and all of the usual things one finds in it, but putting my own twist in it. And as I wrote it, I was having some of the best time I had in years. And out of that came Kill My Mother, which takes place in the first of the trilogy in the 1930s. It starts out in the 1930s and during the Great Depression, and goes into the years of World War II, where it ends in about 1943, I believe. And having written the text of the book, I had to find somebody to illustrate it because, as I said, I didn't know how to draw in that style. I tried it when I was a kid, and I was very bad at it, and I just didn't think I could do it. But when I took it to a publisher, he said, "It's crazy for us to publish a book by you and you don't draw it, so you have to draw it. So go back and show us something." So I did a few sample pages, and what I did to get into the atmosphere of the time, in the 1930s, I went on TV, found some old Turner Classic movies that were shot during the Depression years, froze the frame, drew off the screen, and got inspired by that and did some more and more and more and more and more. And finally, I actually found that I could draw in a style I never could draw in before, because there were new materials that that gave me the freedom that I never had. I never had facility with a black sable brush, which professional cartoonists have to use to do this kind of work. Well, I was lousy at it. So now there were black marker pens that allowed you that facility, and and didn't play into my limitations. So all sorts of things happened in my favor that allowed me to turn out this book that I never dreamed I was any good at or could dream of doing. And it turned out to be an experience that changed my life and changed my career. And I'm on the cusp of it now, having done three of these books and gotten better at each one and got to understand the form and got happier with all of them.
Well, that's so interesting because I would think, well, you know, you draw, you've been drawing for decades and decades. What's so different about noir that you felt you couldn't do it originally? I mean, what about that style is different from any other cartoon you might have done?
Well, because the cartoons I did beginning in The Village Voice in 1956 were simplified drawing, deliberately so, because I didn't want to concentrate on what the reader looked at. I wanted the drawings to serve the purpose of moving the reader and the text that went along with the drawing from panel to panel. The text was the main thing, the dialogue, whether it was a monologue of one character or a duologue with two or more characters. The high point was the storyline, and a complicated drawing, very graphic drawing, drawings from angles, from movie shots, close-ups, medium close-ups, wide-angle views, bird's-eye views, overhead views, worm's-eye views, all of that was anathema to the kind of story I was telling. So the voice cartoons were essentially diagrammatic, in a sense, except for when I did dancers, to get the dialogue across and get the reader through the 6 to 8 or 9 panels in which I would tell the story. So it was a very different and much more simplified form. Noir has to be angle shots, has to be what you remember from the Maltese Falcon or Murder, My Sweet, or any of the Howard Hawks and Edward Dimitrik and various other movies made by brilliant men who did noir in the 40s and 50s, not to mention the late 30s.
Right. I just recently watched The Third Man by...
My God, Carol Reed. That's extraordinary.
Exactly. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with the celebrated cartoonist and author Jules Feiffer about the third in his noir trilogy about the Hollywood blacklist. It's called The Ghost Script. So, you know, you mentioned the angles, and now I understand what you're really talking about. And the book itself, The Ghost Script, in a kind of postmodern way, is itself the book that it is talking about. So tell us what The Ghost Script is.
Well, I started Kill My Mother. I didn't know where I was going. I certainly didn't at the time think I was headed in a political direction. By the time I got to the second volume, which was Cousin Joseph, I realized I was getting into politics and moving toward a politics in the period of time that kind of went back to my young boyhood in the East Bronx when I became politicalized and radicalized in a certain way because of the Hollywood blacklist, which started in the mid-1940s, and where screenwriters and others, actors, have lost their way of making a living because either they were communists or there were liberals who were too far left and they might as well be communists according to the committees who decided these things. There was the House Un-American Activities Committee, the Senate Internal Affairs Committee, and men and women who had found a life that they had been very successful after a period of years suddenly found that they were out of work forever. What seemed forever, unless they would go before Congress and name names of their friends and colleagues who were also suspected communists or communists themselves, and then they too would lose their way of making a living. When you name names, you were allowed to go on making a living. But so this period, which so offended me and outraged me, that having the wrong politics didn't allow you to do what you had trained your life to do, politicized me in a way that kept moving me in that in political directions, oh, I guess for the rest of my life to this very moment.
And so now a little bit to the story. You have you have a private detective who is kind of a classic self-doubting character, a young man named Archie Goldman, who's actually working for his mother. And this allows me to mention, you know, the fact that there are so many strong women characters in this book. Tell us about Archie and tell us about his mom.
Well, let's go back first. Kill My Mother. The private detective in Kill My Mother is more of the classic tough guy private eye. Totally insensitive, doesn't mind beating up people, and ends the book by, I believe, yes, he's killed by the end of that book himself, and which isn't supposed to happen in these private eye books, but I knocked him off. Shot by a woman, of all things. And in the second book, we go back even earlier than the period in Kill My Mother to the earlier years of the Depression, and I give a little background to where all of this came from. And by book three, with the ghost script, I wrap it all up in the Hollywood of 1953, which was the year I got out of the U.S. Army, and started to go to hearings on for the Un-American Activities Committee and see people testify before the committee and see how they got blacklisted, see how they named names or didn't name names, see how they were humiliated or avoided humiliation. And that stuck in my head for all of these years. And this gave me a chance, this third of the books, the ghost script, to revisit that period, but do it in a way that plays and films like Trumbo did not do. And that was to create some wild, thematic, satiric version of what was going on in those years that was both, that is both comic and scary, and take the reader on a ride that says more about this time in many ways than it does about that time. Yeah. But all of that was coincidental because Donald Trump was not on the scene when I wrote the script of the ghost script. He was, I mean, there was no Republican convention. There was no thought of Trump ever being nominated or even being elected president. By the time I finished the art on the book, during the book, Trump, I think, had become president. And all of this that I was doing, all of this about repression, about political sleaziness, had become a round trip for me because we were back in the period that I started my politics in. That's where we are. That's what we're living in now.
Yes, and so tell us a little bit more about the blacklist. I mean, you in this book at one point you describe, or a character describes, the ghost script as a lightly fictionalized treatment of the Hollywood blacklist and the fascist forces who were the prime movers behind it. You know, I have never really seen the kind of analysis that you actually give there. You say that the Hollywood blacklist was a lot about breaking the unions in Hollywood. Is that right?
Well, what I did for my homework was research a bunch of books that had been around for years. Some of them even were out of print. Most, I guess, were out of print. But I went to the library and dug up things here and there. And basically charted my story from what impressed me in my reading in some of the books that I read. And the ones that struck home with me most were the ones that suggested that the whole blacklist was an attempt at not discrediting communism, but destroying the left-wing unions in Hollywood, which were gaining too much power from the point of view of the producers, and making them make too many concessions that they didn't want to make in terms of writers and actors and other creative forces. And they wanted to get rid of these unions. They wanted to basically have unions they could work with, the corrupt unions, the company unions. So the blacklist was created, and the witch hunts were created by the argument of the text that I followed in terms of my story. to basically get rid of the too noisy, too troublesome unions. And it worked.
Would you also say that the McCarthy period in general, that what was behind it was to break the unions that had become so, the industrial unions that had become so powerful during the Depression?
Well, the unions became, but the McCarthy period was later than that. And Joe McCarthy didn't have anything to do with the Hollywood witch hunt. He had witch hunt of, I mean, he got people in the State Department out of work and people in government out of work. McCarthy's main enemies were people in and out and around government, but not, he. It was the Un-American Activities Committee of an earlier time, and in the House, not the Senate, that went after the movie people. So it's the same sense of persecution, but in a different business and with a different purpose in mind.
So there's this mysterious Cousin Joseph, and of course the second book in the trilogy is entitled Cousin Joseph. How much can you tell us about him without giving the story away?
Probably I couldn't give the story away, because the more I'd say about it would just confuse people. So Cousin Joseph represents that mysterious force in and around the movie business that underground, through the back door, tries to influence how films are made, how political messages that these forces don't want on the screen are dropped from the screen, and other political forces are reinforced, and all of it done sub rosa, all of it done conspiratorially. Whether, in fact, there ever was such a thing that existed or not has been debated, and it was very useful for my purposes to give it a life in this book. But the book is a satire.
Yeah, and at one point you have a movie producer in this book, Ghost Script, Jules Feiffer, in your book. There's a movie producer who rejects a script by a Broadway playwright because it's too close to the truth. And he says that they only make movies within acceptable truths framed as entertainment. Is this based on a real Broadway playwright, or is this just part of the fiction of this story?
It's part of the fiction of the story, but all based on things that I know about and happened. So that writer, that playwright, is a combination of several Broadway playwrights whose names I'd rather not mention, but they're very well known. And so are the blacklisted screenwriters who are busy drinking and laughing their way into their own oblivion. One of them was based on a playwright and screenwriter who was for many years was a good friend of mine. So some of these characters are based on real people. Some of them are made up out of whole cloth. And some of them are necessary to exist on a page because of plot contrivance and invention. I mean, the character of Archie Goldman, first of all, Archie got his name because for many years as a kid, I used to addictively read the mysteries by Rex Stout of Nero Wolfe, the private detective who never left his armchair and who sent his assistant named Archie Goodman out to solve the cases and do the homework for the cases and go catch the crooks. So I turned Archie Goldman Jewish, had him work for his mother, who was his Nero Wolfe, and because he was a Jewish detective and he had the kind of introspectiveness and self-doubt that so many of my Jewish types over the years in my comic strip in The Voice had. So he's basically one of my voice characters borrowed and brought to the pages of the graphic novel from Bernard Mergandola Becomes Archie Goldman.
And I was surprised to find out you're a distant cousin to Roy Cohn. I mean, speaking of connections to McCarthy period. And to
yes,
Trump.
Yes. So if you ever ask the question, where's my Roy Cohn, I can answer it.
So as you mentioned before, you put women in powerful positions in this, unlike many noir writers of the classic noir period. And talk a little bit about the strong women who are in these novels and, what inspired you about them? Were there people in your life that inspired them?
Well, that's a tough question to answer. The strong women in my early life were not all that favorable in my eyes, because they were the ones who controlled. They were in my family, and they were controlling forces who I was long in opposition to. But by the same token, they helped form my opinions, they helped form my politics or my counter-politics, and they were part of my consciousness and subconsciousness from the time I was a young man to this very moment. So what I always found interesting over the years was the conversations and the relationships with strong women who weren't allowed to be strong in the 40s and the 50s. And when I started going around talking at colleges, giving speeches, after I first hit it big, I would often get picked up at the airport or train station, however I was going, by young women who were students and assigned to guide me through the ropes. And as we got to know each other in the course of the day or so, what came out is that, because we would have conversations that they would have, I was always, 10, 15 years older than they were, that we would start having conversations. She said she was never able to talk to anybody else this way, any male this way, because they would be intimidated, that she couldn't be that bright, as bright as they were. They were afraid to show how smart they were. They couldn't get away with showing how decisive they were. They had to act in disguise in order to get along and to get by with their friends and on the campus and all of that. And I didn't hear just one of these stories. I heard them everywhere I went, and it horrified me that smart, young, attractive, often women with inventive intelligences found that in order to get along with their lives, they had to have a different life and pretend to be somebody else. So that always stuck with me, and that's at the bottom of why of the women characters I write and draw, to give them a chance to come out of their own closet.
And they are quite striking. Now, this in many ways seems to be a golden age for the graphic novel. And I'm sure that you've been an influence just by being a cartoonist and illustrator on many young graphic novelists. What do you think about graphic novels these days? What do you feel about the burgeoning of this field?
I think it's been a golden age for some time now. There's some extraordinary. I mean, of course, as in any field, there's a lot of crap, and some of that crap is what's most successful. But that's the way things have always been in arts. What's most exciting is the work done by a few people, and there are quite enough of them. I mean, to stop you in your tracks. And, I get work sent to me, and I think I don't have any time to read this, and I'll just look at the first few pages, and then I drop everything, and I don't do anything else for the next hour or so but get devoured by this new work, which has such an interesting point of view and so beautiful graphically and so stunning and stirring, usually by somebody who's 50 or 60 years younger than I am. And it's clear in some cases that they've been influenced by me. But it also goes round robin. Because of the insights in much of the new work that I've read over the years, I've been influenced by youngers, and happily so. And so it goes here, you keep learning and you keep discovering and you keep finding new things by people who are several generations younger than you, who teach you new tricks, or I hope I hope I learn them.
And what are some of the authors that you particularly like?
One of them is a great children's book illustrator who has started doing graphic novels, and he's a friend of mine, and I'm drawing a blank on his name. Here it is. Here's his book. Yes, David Small. Do you know David Small's work?
No.
Well, it's his Stitches was his first book, and his new book, Home After Dark is a leap in an entirely different direction, and masterful. And we're friends, and I am thrilled by the friendship, and I might not be doing graphic novels at all if I hadn't read Stitches in the first place, which inspired me to do Kill My Mother.
Well, that's wonderful, and I am so glad that you have done these. I mean, I assume this is the end of the trilogy.
Yes, trilogy is over, and my experiences with noir are over. Therefore, I am no longer a noir graphic novelist, but I got so in love with the form of the graphic novel that I thought, why don't I try doing a series for younger readers, from readers from ages 9 to 14 or something like that, and base it on kind of sci-fi fantasy, which is a big deal for readers today. And now I'm somebody who never liked sci-fi, never liked fantasy, never had much patience with any of this stuff. But I thought it's something I should do some homework on and see if I can come up with an idea. So I did some homework, got interested, came up with a scenario for a storyline of two or three parts. And at the moment, it may or may not be sold to a publisher, and I may have a series that follows. It's there are negotiations going on right at this moment, but I don't know where they're going to end up.
Well, that's great. Maybe you're picking up the mantle of Stan Lee, which he just passed away. Well, Jules Pfeiffer, it has just been a delight to speak with you. Your latest book is The Ghost Script, the third in the trilogy, after Kill My Mother and Cousin Joseph. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you so much. And can I add one other plug?
Yeah.
Which is just about a month ago, I started doing a biweekly political cartoon, something I swore I'd never do again, for an online publication called Tablet Magazine. And if anybody is interested in seeing me return to politics, they can go online and look up Tablet, and they will find me every 2 weeks.
Jules Pfeiffer. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to his column at Tablet. Next up, we listen back to my interview with comic artist Art Spiegelman. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Let's listen now to an abridged version of my interview with cartoonist Art Spiegelman. It was recorded in 2008 when the show was still produced at WMUA in Amherst, Massachusetts. When Art Spiegelman came out with Mouse in 1986, the book exploded notions about the limited role of comics as art and literature. Winning a special Pulitzer Prize in 1992, the only comic book ever to do so, Mouse is a memoir in graphic form of Spiegelman's father's experiences in Auschwitz and the impact that had on the artist's own childhood growing up in New York City. His mother was also a survivor of the Nazi concentration camps. In 1968, she committed suicide soon after Spiegelman himself was released from a mental hospital after suffering a nervous breakdown. Mouse was prefigured in an earlier work, Prisoner on the Hell Planet, and in 1978, Spiegelman included that and other works in a collection of his underground comics called Breakdowns. Innovative and drawn in a variety of styles in large format, Breakdowns sank like a stone. But now Spiegelman has reissued it with a new 20-page introduction that's worth the price of the book alone. Our interview was recorded last week, and on my way into the studio in the basement of the campus center here at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, I noticed a slender young guy manning the table of the UMass Comic Arts Society in the main concourse. I stopped in to chat for a few minutes. He told me his name, Curtis Sarkin, and that he draws comic strips for the campus newspaper, The Daily Collegian, and is an English major. On impulse, I asked Curtis if he would like to join me in interviewing Art Spiegelman. Well, as you can imagine, his eyes lit up, and a few hours later, Curtis sat down with me in front of the microphones as Art Spiegelman joined us on the phone from his book tour. Well, Art Spiegelman, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thanks for having me, Francesca.
Now, you have reissued this book, Breakdowns, with an extensive introduction. It's a memoir told in the form of a graphic novel. What's the relationship between Breakdowns and your earlier Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Mouse?
Well, it was the... Should I correct several phrases that made me
bristle? Yes.
I don't know what it is, but I'm not sure that it's a graphic novel. I think of it as comics, maybe comics with an X. And there's something else, but I forget now. Early on in your... Oh, yes, a reissue. Really what it is it's a rebirth.
Say more about that.
Well, there's a book I made in 1978, or end of 77. There was a gathering of my rather strange works from 72 to 77 in a very large deluxe format at a time where that didn't exist, gathering work that was partially autobiographical and partially, I never know the word, formal, experimental. There wasn't a phrase like deconstructionist, but maybe it was deconstruct. I don't know what to call it, but experimental comics. And it's that work that ultimately was what gave birth to The Long Mouse. In a couple of ways. One, the first three-page version of Mouse that had been done for an underground comic was the earliest piece collected in this book, and an important one for me in terms of finding my own way as a maker of stuff. And also because the book itself was so formidably out of step with anything cultural around it that it disappeared. It just was published into a sea of silence, and I realized if I want to keep making comics, I better tell a story that people can understand quickly and in one reading, even if they could go back and reread it, as opposed to the comics that were in that original Breakdowns book that were, you had to read them only so that you could go back and reread them, many of those pieces. That was the only way to find what was actually there. But I don't think of them as, I mean, they were in a way the opposite of graphic novels, even though I know I'm considered one of the daddies of the graphic novel these days. I'm still asking for a blood test because although I really admire and love a lot of what's going on around me, it's amazing. It's by its nature, it tends to the very long. And sometimes that works really well. Like Mouse was a long work, but it was also a very compressed work. It's 300 pages that I suppose if I had done it with a different set of rhythms could have been an 800 or 900 or more page book.
Compressed in what way?
Well, in terms of how much... How charged with information is it? You know, I think back in the 70s, I had to write something about my work, and I was just using the metaphor of concentrated orange juice that you use your brain as the water for. I mean, I don't quite know how to describe it, which is why I never even thought the book would come back into the world, even though all of those pieces, I'm very, not all, but many of the pieces in that relatively short book are the cornerstones of what I understand. So it's not exactly like, oh, he's publishing his old work, he's getting it out of the bottom drawer, and he's just shoving it back in the world. It's not like I think of it as juvenilia. I just think of it as the core of what I think about even when I was making Mouse. And it tends toward a high degree of concentrated visual information and bursts of language that are then to be unpacked later. Is this making any sense?
It is making sense as you're saying it, and I definitely want to explore a little bit more about that. But first, actually, I would like to bring in and introduce to you my guest co-host today here, Curtis Sarkin, who is a student here at UMass. He's also a comic strip artist, and he's a member of the Amherst Comic Art Society. Curtis?
I'm part of the UMass Amherst Comic Art Society.
Hi, Curtis. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
And I know he's got some questions, too, but I kind of want to go back to this unpacking, and maybe if I could for a minute connect it up again with Mouse. I mean, Mouse is such an amazing classic, and in fact, Curtis was telling me that he has as assigned reading in two of his classes. Is that right, Curtis?
Yeah, comparative literature as well as English, one of which wasn't even focusing on comics, just society and literature.
And I wanted to get your reaction to that.
Well, you know, when it first started happening, I was worried because, you know, when I was in, I think, junior high school, I had to read Silas Marner, and it almost kept me from ever reading again anything. So at first I was like really concerned that, oh, geez, it's going to become like medicine. You know, you've got to read it and write papers on it and analyze it. But then I tend to fret a lot and worry. And on the other hand, I got to say that the way it's played out hasn't been that at all. It's been just probably what keeps the book in print, since most books have about the same shelf life as yogurt. It keeps this thing being attended to and read, and it does show up in the oddest classes. Like, there's somebody who told me once that it was in an Eskimo literature class, and like, he couldn't explain why, but obviously the teacher liked the book. And then more than once I've been told it's been used in psych classes to study the dysfunctional family, which I consider a bad
honor. That's a compliment there. Well, talking about dysfunctional families, actually, you open Breakdowns, actually the introduction to Breakdowns, which is a lengthy one.
Well, that's the thing, Francesco, when you said it was a reissue, I was going, no, it's a rebirth, because basically it's a new book that has this other book at its heart. Like, what started out as an introduction is half as long as the book itself.
That's right, and it's a very, very powerful. I mean, I had to stop and process it as I was going through it, and I think that gets back to your idea of the compression.
You got it, that's right.
Yeah, and in it, you begin with talking about your mother. Your parents were Holocaust survivors. You told their story in Mouse, A Survivor's Tale. And here you begin, you have a drawing of you dressed in the striped pajamas of a concentration camp inmate yourself. And you say, in 1968, my mother killed herself and she left no note. First of all, why do you open with this? And then tell us, why are you in striped pajamas?
Well, okay, to answer that, I have to explain that that panel acts like what Linda Barry just wrote me an email about the book and described as a wormhole. You know, it's like there are things in the strip at the beginning called Portrait of the Artist as a Young exclamation point, Arabat asterisk exclamation point, or blankety blank, as they say in comics. And the introduction are all memories based on me looking back on a work I did 30 years ago, right? So in that particular sequence that's called Hell Planet, it refers to the strip Prisoner on the Hell Planet that was in that 1978 book. And that line you're just reading as a thought balloon is pretty much the same as the first panel of the 1978 strip. In 1968, my mother killed herself and she left no note. And there I am, drawn in a very different style, in a German expressionist woodcut style maybe, also dressed in complete concentration camp regalia. And as I say, the strip was called Prisoner on the Hell Planet. And that strip was probably the one that really made me understand the kind of comics I wanted to make, rather than my version of how to draw Keep on Trucking or Pervert Pirates or other Zap Comics, All-Star kind of things that I was basically imitating and striving toward in the years prior to 71, 72. And that strip is highly emotionally charged, and it deals with the ways in which I feel imprisoned by my mother's death. And ultimately, that strip was printed, although way, way, way too small, as a four-page thing within the Mouse books.
Way too small?
Oh, it's way too small. You know, comics are words and pictures. And actually, it's a simple question that has an interesting answer, which is comics are, more than most things, site-specific.
Site-specific?
Yeah. You know, like, it's not the same to take a comic book and print it, like, 10 inches by 14 inches or 5 inches by 7 inches. It's unlike most of the writers, I suppose, that are on your show. They can print their book in any typeface that they choose, on any format that they choose. And comics really are meant to, they have some kind of ideal ratio for what they should be when they're printed. And the Breakdowns work is all quite a large format book. It's 11 by 14. Mouse is, I don't know what, like 6 by 9 at the most or something like that. It's a much more small and intimate scale.
Yeah.
And that intimacy was an aspect of what I wanted to make happen in Mouse. So you would climb into the story and stay there as if you were reading prose, but with images that are very articulated, but are still, it's a picture book, but where the narrative element of let's flip pages and read is one of the concerns, and the intimacy is one of the concerns. So I drew all the pictures in Mouse the same size as the book that you're reading.
So you're actually thinking about the quality of the attention of the viewer, of the reader.
Yeah, when the pictures are big, your eye skitters around the page differently, and you're asked to take the measure of the work in a different way, quite literally. I think it's one of the reasons why there is such a thing as a graphic novel society on campus, and why comics seem to be doing well while the rest of America turns to sludge as things that one can find in bookstores, because almost by definition, comics take advantage of their bookness.
What you're saying about the size and just being able to see a big picture of it. It seems almost to me similar to like a CD album cover compared to a original record cover, the way you just look at that picture and it's so big and in your face, it's a lot
right.
more
graphic
powerful.
Designers would not make the Sgt. Pepper cover for
exactly.
The CD release. It never would have happened.
Huh.
So that kind of visual aspect of comics, which is at least half the game, one does different things for different sites, for different occasions. And so the Breakdowns book had to be large. And that's when, in fact, why it got born. It's not like somebody's saying, oh, we all want Spiegelman's work that he did from 1972 to 1977. It certainly wasn't the case. In the first edition of Breakdowns, there was like 4,000 copies that took quite a few years to disappear. But it was because I needed to see the work that way. It had been printed first too small in Underground Comics, and then in the Mao's books, way too small. It's just I didn't know how else to get through the narrative need to talk about my mother's suicide without skipping outside that mouse-cat metaphor that I'd been working with and enter this into the deposition, if that's what it is.
You know, it reminds me of a section of this book, and I'm speaking with Art Spiegelman about his rebirth of Breakdowns. It's the 1978 comics that he came out with. Now has a long introduction, and I believe this is part of the introduction as well. And this is a little section called Form and Content.
Right near the end of the 20-page so-called introduction.
Yeah, exactly. And so here we're talking about form and content and their interrelationship with each other. Could you describe a little bit about what you are saying here? And do you have the book there with you?
I just grabbed it, yeah.
Great. So, you know, it's a little awkward because this is radio and I can't show our listeners, but there is there's basically the reprise of an earlier section in this part of the book, and they show a bully who's coming after the young Art Spiegelman, and also the same bully who has gone after his mother, spit upon his mother. So could you talk a little bit about this connection between, well, what's the form and what's the content? Are the words...
Well, you know, these are Siamese twins. These are joined at the hip things that only language really separates, but different things tend to happen, which is, in that first section, one's getting an anecdote about little Art Spiegelman in 1954 when he's 6 years old. And again, very condensed, very compressed, life in the playground with a mommy on the park, and the kid getting knocked over, the kid Spiegelman getting knocked over by a bigger kid who steals his bolo paddle ball toy, and when the mother on the bench reprimands him, he throws the paddle ball toy at the mother who the young Art Spiegelman has gone to for shelter, and then the bully comes over, spits at the mother, and then walks away and kind of trying to maintain his calm, little Art Spiegelman says, he was a bad boy, right, Mommy? Yes. So this was my fugitive refugee mother at a moment where I finally, at the age of six, discovered my parents can't protect me. Mm-hmm. I have to get my shelter elsewhere. And the title for that sequence is The Insult That Made a Man Out of Mac, with a Charles Atlas bodybuilding ad behind it, which was where I looked to for counsel when my parents didn't work out. I'd go to my comic books. And so that's a sequence that was, again, inspired by looking at the Hell Planet part of the Breakdowns book. And that leads to a section toward the end, at the end of the Portrait of the Artist stuff, as you say, called Form and Content, in which it's replayed in a whole different way. It's replayed with the colors shifting away from their outlines and forcing you to take another look at these pictures. And it guides you toward the aspects of Breakdowns that were not so involved in, just as I said when we were talking earlier, well, they just want a story. Let's give them a story they can read and not have to reread and worry about to get at least the lay of the land. It was when I got very interested in the formal aspects of what comics could be. And so the language in that section is a quotation from, I think, relatively obscure Russian formalist aesthetician named Viktor Shklovsky, and the quotation basically talks about the purpose of art. The purpose of art is to impart the sensation of things as they are perceived, not as they are known. Art exists that one may recover the sensation of life. It exists to make one feel things, to make the stone stony. The technique of art is to make objects unfamiliar, to make forms difficult, to increase the difficulty and length of perception, because the process of perception is an aesthetic end in itself, and it must be prolonged. Art is a way of experiencing the artfulness of an object. The object is not important. And that matched up with my notions of what comics could do that was way outside the loop of the stoned-out comics and taboo-busting underground comic stuff that surrounded me and that I'd been working on prior to that. And it was very, very far away from finding an audience that could follow along with me. It's one of the reasons I'm happily surprised to see the book even coming out again. And that section that I was just quoting is hard to, like, give you the full meaning of without having you look at the pictures along with me, but most of the pictures are, oh, God, what can I say? They're whacked versions of the first version that you saw, with some things upside down, inside out, colors not following the outlines, and yet right in the middle of it, there's that boy spitting again where you see him quite clearly. That content is unobstructed.
Exactly. There's that one panel, which is just like the one before. I mean, you get the full force and sense, the emotional sense of what's going on. I guess you recover the sensation of that life as it was lived.
That's the point. And also to make you stay with it. Like, you know, it's very different from the comics that I love and did love and that people associated with comics until they got rechristened graphic novels, which is the disposable thing. You read it once in a newspaper, then you wrap fish in it. You read a comic book, curl it up, put it in your back pocket, and don't keep track of what happened to it later. That's how most comics were consumed, and that's how most comics were made, for that kind of consuming. That's real different than making something where you've got the same freedom and responsibilities that somebody making a painting or writing a novel might have. I'm sorry, Curtis, I interrupted you.
That's all right. Now, why is it that it seems each little story in this book is an entirely different style from the first one? Is there a specific reason you decided to not go with a certain style throughout?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's several reasons. One is that I have about 500 people living inside my brain, just like everybody else, but only about three of them can draw. Part of it also is just that I never kind of moved toward wanting to have one kind of trademark style, you know, that's something that one is sort of taught to do as a commercial artist. Like, it's your brand, the same way that General Electric is a brand. It's great for illustrators because they can get a gig from an art director that says, do that again. But for me, the form and content thing that Francesco was talking about is basic to the way I understand stuff, which is the way something looks on its surface is just part of the content. Like that style that Maus was drawn in was invented for the purpose. It wasn't a way I was drawing prior to that.
Are you still developing new styles then?
Well, kind of, or reflecting and remixing other styles as best I can with my relatively limited natural-born talent, so that each memory in that first section that you've plucked out a couple of just now, there's different ways of they look different from each other in a way. They have the same color palette and all the panels are the same size, but if you go from one of those little sequences to another, you'll see that some of them are drawn with a brush, some with a pen, some more exaggerated cartooning, some far less exaggerated cartoon styles, and I can't necessarily verbalize why each of those styles is used for each sequence, but it felt right in terms of giving that particular memory. Mm-hmm. And it's just one of the aspects of comics grammar is the surface look of something, so that some of it echoes underground comic styles that were around me, much more rubbery in its drawing, like I'm looking at a sequence that is done at the time that I was drawing that Prisoner on the Hell Planet thing. Some of it looks more like Mad Comic styles with more jam-packed background. Some of it is done in some kind of wacky, circa 1960, offbeat, less is more, post-Bauhaus cartoon style. Some of it looks like it's in that Tintin clear line style. And all of those are ways of giving the texture of that specific memory.
That was an abridged version of our 2008 interview with comic artist Art Spiegelman. I was accompanied by guest co-host Curtis Sarkin. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to the whole interview. The great Israeli writer Amos Oz died last week, and with his death, a voice for reason and tolerance went silent. A few months back, I received unbidden in my mail a copy of Oz's last book, Dear Zealots. I hadn't known it had been published. Caught up with a backlog of interviews and scheduled air dates, I took my time in responding. But I kept the book on my bedside table, where it called to me to read it every time my eye fell on it. Finally, I did, and was profoundly moved. The book is a cry of the heart and of a brilliant mind against the fanaticism that is sweeping the world, and most particularly for Oz, the land where he was born and lived all his life, Israel. My copy of the book soon filled up with dog ears and post-it tabs marking notable passages. Let me quote one passage I marked. As the questions grow harder and more complicated, people yearn for simpler answers, one-sentence answers that point unhesitatingly to a culprit who can be blamed for all our suffering, answers that promise that if we only eradicate the villains, all our troubles will vanish. Amos Oz decried the extremist loathing that he said was, quote, more and more commonly the strongest public sentiment, loathing of each side for the other, and he called such extreme loathing a component of fanaticism in all its guises. He tied it to the, as he wrote, increasing infantilization of masses of people everywhere in the world. No coincidence, he said, because there are those who stand to gain from it and those who ride its coattails, whether from a thirst for power or a thirst for wealth. Yet, for Amos Oz, hope for partial immunity against fanaticism lay in human curiosity and imaginative power. Quote, to imagine the inner world, both intellectual and emotional, of the other. To use our imagination, even in times of strife. To use it also primarily in moments when we feel a surge of fury, insult, loathing, righteousness, and the certainty that we've been wronged and that justice is entirely on our side. Perhaps also to ask once in a while, what if I were her, or him, or them? To step for a moment into the other's shoes and under his skin, not in order to cross the river or be reborn, but simply to understand, to sense what is there. What is beyond the river? What do they have in their head? How do they feel over there? And what do we look like from there? Perhaps also to try to find out how deep the dividing river is, how wide, how and where might we build a bridge? This curiosity will not necessarily lead us to a conclusion of sweeping moral relativity, nor to self-abdication in favor of the other's selfhood. It will lead us, sometimes, to an exhilarating discovery, which is that there are many rivers, each of whose banks can show us a different landscape that may be fascinating and surprising. Fascinating even if it is not right for us, surprising even if it does not appeal to us. Perhaps, indeed, in curiosity lies the prospect of openness and tolerance. A great message for the new year. After reading Dear Zealots, I immediately, if belatedly, contacted the Houghton Mifflin publicist who's handling the book and requested an interview. She answered quickly to say she would ask the author for a time to schedule it. A few weeks went by, and when I followed up, I learned that Oz was sick and unable to schedule an interview. Then, not long after, I learned of his passing. I'm sad that I did not get a chance to speak with Amos Oz, and sadder that the world must now stumble on without him. But I am profoundly grateful for his voice and for this slim last volume that he left us, Dear Zealots. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.